we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, June the 30th, 2017. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Jen Dobell.
Hello.
And our guest co-host, Jillian Walters.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us today. We have a big animal advocacy event happening here in Vancouver next Saturday, July the 8th. It's called Roaring Silence, and it's happening globally. On today's show, we'll have the organizer of next week's Vancouver event, Daphna Kedem, to speak with us and tell us more about this demo. And for our feature interview, we'll be welcoming back Dr. Mark Beckhoff to the show. Mark Beckhoff is a world-leading animal behavior expert who has written over 1,000 papers and 30 books on the topics of animal behavior and the study of animal minds. And his latest book, co-authored with Jessica Pierce, is called The Animal's Agenda: Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age. It's a fascinating and insightful read, and Mark will be here today to share some of the ideas he explores in the book. That interview is coming up in 28 minutes, so please do stay tuned for that. Well, it's summertime and rodeo season is amongst us again. And Jillian, I know you have some thoughts on the rodeo that you'd like to share.
Yes, the Williams Lake Stampede is happening this weekend, and the Vancouver Humane Society has a current campaign which states that rodeo is cruel to animals because it unnecessarily subjects them to fear, pain, stress, and the risk of injury or death for the purpose of human entertainment. And in my research this week, I found that there's a long list of evidence to back this up. Over the years, hundreds of animals have died during calf roping and chuck wagon racing, as well as thousands that die unreported when the cowboys are in training. It's quite difficult, actually, for me to understand how this blatant animal cruelty is allowed to continue. But like most animal exploitation, I'm reminded that tradition, financial gain, and politics are at play. In fact, in May of this year, the Vancouver Humane Society tried to book a full-page ad in the Williams Lake Tribune to express opposition to the Williams Lake Stampede Rodeo, right. And the paper declined, stating that they are a sponsor and a supporter of the stampede.
I think that's really sad when that's, you know, that's freedom of speech, you could say, that is being declined. And you would think that that's something that is speaking up against blatant cruelty, we would be allowed to voice that in a publication. I mean, what does it mean when your local newspaper is declining ads that actually have an ethical message to them, right? It's being shown that they are being paid to decline that.
Yeah, right? It shows the power of the influence of media and the power of the culture of the rodeo.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always quite disgusted myself to find out, and every year the Calgary Stampede is coming up next week too, right? And every single year we see in the news stories of animals being injured and then being put down in those events. It happens every year. We have a long list that the Vancouver Humane Society has put out, and for years and years and years, every year there are animals that have been injured. So I know you have some info about like these events, right? Like calf roping and chuck wagon races, for example.
For those who don't know what happens, why don't you tell us a bit more?
Well, actually, I'm just overwhelmed at the in-your-face cruelty. Other like animal exploitation, like the zoos and aquariums and circuses kind of hide the cruelty, but rodeos are just right in your face.
It's very glorified.
Yes. Calf roping, which is also, I looked on the website and they call it the down roping. And it's a timed event where a calf is goaded, which means that its tail's twisted. They kick it or knock the calf's head against the bars. They often use electric shock devices to force it into the arena. And then it starts running at about 27 miles per hour. A horse and a rider follow the calf. Remember, this is a baby cow, a calf. It is then roped around the neck and jerked to a sudden stop. And the calf struggles to his feet If it struggles to its feet, it'll be lifted and thrown to the ground by the rider, who then ties three of the calves' feet together. And all the while, the crowd is screaming and cheering, and often the cowboy gets rewarded in cash for doing something like this.
Just hearing about that actually makes me really sad. Of course, we've seen the photos as well. I don't know if I've actually ever seen this on TV, or actually we watched that film documentary Cowboy Up last year.
Yeah.
It's on CBC, and you can actually see it on cbc.ca/docs. It's still there. And there was a whole documentary about the culture of the rodeo and people raising their children to be a part of the rodeo. But actually, just going back to the calf roping, that just makes me really sad.
Yeah.
Cows are beautiful animals. Calves peaceful. Are the most peaceful, innocent, loving creatures. And it disgusts me. And you're right, Jillian. It's blatant. Why can't people see this?
Mm-hmm. And it's the culture. And it's a confusing paradox because, as a society, we teach our children, you be kind to animals. But then on the other hand, we glorify violence against another animal and reward violence.
That is the part that I find most shocking when I think about even just veganism. We have children's books teaching children to love animals. We teach them to be kind to animals and serve them meat at dinner time and a glass of milk. And it's we need to wake up, everybody. And we need to stop all this.
The rodeos are unfortunately known to be family events too, because it's not just animal events that they have at the rodeo. I guess it's a whole day of fun for the whole family. Jen, I know you have some experience on the other side of the fence of the rodeo. What have you experienced just in terms of people going into the rodeo where you've been protesting?
So I don't like to call it protesting because that conjures up images of people with signs yelling and shaming, and that's not my style. It's a demonstration. It's an educational outreach event where we're pleading with people kindly and politely to enjoy their day at the fair, but please avoid the rodeo events, and here's why. And then we'll go up and down the lineup and speak with people about the kinds of things that the animals go through. And Jillian, you mentioned the electric shock to get the animals into the ring. These are things that people aren't necessarily seeing when they go to the rodeo. Of course, they are seeing a lot of blatant cruelty. And if they can't acknowledge that with their own eyes, then I don't know how to help them. But it does help to go on and talk about how the animals are transported to the event and how they're kept between events and how it really is all about human entertainment and animal suffering. And I hate going to these events, Allison, to answer your question, because I rarely have anyone say, oh, thanks for letting me know. I'm not going to go there. I don't want to teach my kids that. It's a lot of opposition and heckling and making fun of activists. And I wonder what impact that has on their children when they see their parents treating us this way. It reminds me of a time when my dad and I were driving to the Commonwealth Games for my dance practice. I was in the opening ceremonies, and we passed some activists that were doing some kind of environmental activism, and he criticized them for handing out their information on paper, making them hypocrites. This is exactly the kind of attitude that we get from people when we do public outreach. They're going to find some way to make us look like hypocrites so they can continue to ignore us, including saying nice leather shoes when we're wearing fake leather shoes. They'll grasp at anything to put us down. And I think that does have an impact on their children's views, because children look up to their parents.
I think it's important too to change that frame of mind, is like, put your dog in that position. You'd be outraged.
That's a great point.
If they were doing that. And it turns out that a lot of people are outraged. In fact, a poll in 2015 shows that 63% of people in Canada are opposed to the rodeo. So things are shifting. The rodeo is banned in several countries. Also, the city of Vancouver has banned rodeos, and North Vancouver. And there's more that you can do if you're interested. I just wrote two letters, one to the Williams Lake Stampede Society, as well as the mayor of Williams Lake. So you can do that too. It'll be on Co-op Radio Facebook page.
It's great. On the Animal Voices Vancouver Facebook page. I posted it there yesterday, so just take a look at that. It'll tell you what to do. Good job for writing those letters, and thanks for that info, Jillian.
You're welcome.
And we have some upcoming events. So as many of you may know, I do a lot of activism for whales in captivity. And for those who have questions that are unanswered, we have the event for you. So a lot of people say, where are the whales going to go if you don't want them in captivity? If they've been born into captivity and they can't be released to the wild, there is an event being put on by the Whale Sanctuary Project. It will be on July the 11th. Dr. Lori Marino, who leads this project, is going to be speaking. Tickets will be only $15. The event is from 7:30 to 9:30, again, July the 11th, Roundhouse Community Center. More information has just been posted on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And in other exciting news, Vegan Supply, Vancouver's first all-vegan grocery store, has opened at 250 East Pender in Vancouver's Chinatown. They don't have all the inventory yet, but the store is pretty full. New items arriving every day. Come on down, let them know your thoughts. Previous to this, customers ordered from Vegan Supply online and picked up their items from the all-vegan meat restaurants in Vancouver. So this is going to be a little more convenient. And I just saw their products at Vancouver's Veg Expo, and I was like a kid in a candy store. There's really great
vegan cheeses. It literally is a candy store.
Well, there is candy, yes. Candy. Not made from ground-up animal bones, as most candy is. So please, go check it out. Also, July 22nd, this is a really fun event. This isn't necessarily vegan, but I am creating a vegan team for it. It's the World Naked Bike Ride from 12 to 6 at Sunset Park, July 22nd. More information on the Facebook page, World Naked Bike Ride 2017. Dress code is as bare as you dare. And I went a couple years ago. I wore bikini bottoms and nothing else. Of course, a helmet. I'm inviting all my vegan activist friends and encouraging them to represent a vegan message in some way on their bodies or on their bikes. You can easily attach a sign to your bike saying powered by plants or something like that. Let's get that message out there that vegans are healthy and strong and willing to go around naked on their bikes. The National Animal Rights Conference is coming up in Washington, D.C., August 3rd to 6th. More information on Facebook page, National Animal Rights Conference 2017. And Allison and I are going to be attending along with many of our Facebook friends who we've never actually met in person. They're coming from all over.
I've met lots of them because I go every year.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to meeting John Sackers, actually.
Oh, right. We had him on the show recently.
We did have him on the show. And we're going to be singing a song outside the White House to record for one of his next YouTube videos. You're welcome to join us. And we have two Chicken Save demonstrations happening this weekend, back to back. Vancouver Chicken Save from 9 to 11 a.m., the corner of Hastings and Commercial at Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse, and Surrey Chicken Save from 1 to 3 at Sunrise Poultry Processors, 13542 73rd Avenue. You can find both those events on Facebook as well under the Save Movements for Vancouver and Surrey. Signs are provided and all are welcome. And one final event we have, July 19th, is the Night of the Neophytes. We'll be having a rock and roll night of vegan awareness at Pat's Pub and Brew House. Gal-fronted rock and roll bands, a talk by animal rights lawyer Anna Pippis, who we've had on the show many times, and dinner provided by none other than vegan, plant-based food and natural products. You must buy in advance your tickets to get to the dinner, and you can only do that by contacting Night of the Neophytes on Facebook. All dinner tickets must be bought by July 9th. They're $25, includes a $15 gourmet dinner.
Well, thank you for those events, Jen. That's a lot of stuff happening.
So much going on.
Okay, for our first interview today, we have local Vancouver animal advocate Daphna Kedem on the show. She is the organizer of the Vancouver edition of the Roaring Silence demonstration event, which will take place next Saturday, July the 8th in downtown Vancouver. This is a global demo that strives to bring awareness and heighten compassion for the animals who are killed, exploited, confined and tortured in the food and fur industries for research, for entertainment, fashioned, and as decoration. Daphna is here today to tell us about the event. Hi, Daphna. Welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show today to tell us about Roaring Silence. I'm excited to be attending that next week. I know you're spearheading the Vancouver edition here next weekend. Can you tell us about the origins of Roaring Silence and how you became to be involved?
Yes, sure. I learned about the Roaring Silence demonstration after seeing a YouTube video of the event in Tel Aviv. It was there organized by Israeli Animal Liberation Front. It was very impressive, very powerful. There were over 1,000 activists and demonstration compassion. And I found it truly inspiring, and I just wanted to bring it over here.
Great. And so, you know, we recently had about 400 animal advocates in Vancouver come out to give their support for the animals in the march to close all slaughterhouses. There was also National Animal Rights Day, the demo before that, that was globally also held all over the world. So what can people expect when they go to attend Roaring Silence next weekend? Roaring Silence, that term is a bit of an oxymoron, and I'm curious.
Yes. Well, it is the first large-scale silent protest event in North America. I am very excited just to add something new for the local activists. We're very dedicated to bring out the message of compassion in all forms. And there's not just one way of doing activism. This is just another channel. And standing in silence for me, for example, is means standing for the victims, you can compare it to a funeral. It's remembering the victims. It's staying silent, listening to their suffering, honoring them. And I think in such a large scale, this is something new. We do vigils, local vigils, do also stand in silence. But this is because it's a large scale. It's much more empowering, and it is a bit of an oxymoron. That's why you said there were loads of big demonstrations in Vancouver with many more attendants. For the first year, Roaring Silence is its first year, and compared, let's say, to March Against All Slaughterhouse, which is a very clear message. This was our second year in Vancouver, and the numbers in the first year were lower, so I'm optimistic that the arts movement will grow, so more enthusiastic activists will join once they know what it is about. So Roaring Silence is roaring in silence. It's just listening and honoring the victims. I'm sure once activists will know that what the message is, people will be new to it, and I have to say, the organizing team from the Vancouver to close all march, close all slaughterhouses, are sharing their experiences with us for protest event organization. So it's Vancouver activists are taking part of it. So they have their skills in the social media and in these events. So people can expect to gather at 12 noon downtown by the Laughing Statue and pick up a sign that will be provided to everyone. It's unified forms. You won't see a different signs than you would see in other marches. They're all unified and they all send a message. And one side is wording, the other side is a strong image from different decoration of being used an animal, what you said in the introduction. It's all very different visuals. We will form two lines or one line. It really depends on how many participants. Now we have over 160, which is very impressive for the first time. And we march silently along the seawall. And people simply observe and see and take a message. And we want to share what we feel and take it out there and have people know. The signs themselves are very impactful. You cannot ignore them. I want to point out that many of the images were taken by the talented Joanne MacArthur of We Animal, who's been in so many places around the world and bearing witness of animal suffering. So it's out there. We just want to bring it out more. It's a powerful moment for the activists, and I think Vancouver needs it now. It's the right momentum. A month after Close All Slaughterhouses March, we're ready for another big demonstration.
Sounds great. Jen has a question for you here.
Hi, Daphna.
Hello.
What are some of the animal advocacy issues that are close to your heart that's inspiring you to put on this event personally?
Farm animals are find the worst to suffer, from chickens to pigs and cows. We sabotage their lives in so many atrocious ways. It's unthinkable. We can choose different, and we completely disregard them, their needs, and their products, our statistics, numbers, and I see it now, and I wish I'd seen it before, but we all know that they deserve better, which is some of us just don't want to see it. And, yeah, farm animals, and seeing an animal and calling it by giving it a name and knowing that they react to you, and that's what I see in animal sanctuaries, for example, and I think everyone should go, is it's very impactful, and it just makes a big change in lives to actually meet them in person. How many people that eat turkeys actually seen a live turkey, actually petted him, actually seen through their eyes? It makes a big difference.
It's Jillian. Hi.
Hi, Jillian.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. So you have a Kickstarter campaign going on now till July 4th to raise funds for the event. Can you tell us about that and how people can help?
Yes, if they just visit the roaringsilence.ca, they can click through right to the Kickstarter, where you can see different rewards and levels of pledges to choose from. Rewards range from pins, I think the most selling now is the Roaring Silence t-shirts, in addition to other t-shirts. I'm glad you're asking. I, at the same time, launched my own vegan t-shirts brand called VT's, which just gives additional vegan method shirts and even onesies and shirts for kids, for little ones. I found that the Vancouver scene is missing t-shirts for kids, and this is something I put also on the Kickstarter. So basically buying the Roaring Silence t-shirts, where you can see on Facebook and Kickstarter, and many local companies also in town are already selling them. Very, very impressive.
Well, yeah, that sounds great. So I just wanted to mention that for your Kickstarter campaign, you are trying to raise, there's many costs associated with this event, right? And you have a goal of several thousand dollars. I know you're still working on that, and that Kickstarter stops on July the 4th and needs to be funded. So we have a link on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, that I posted a day or two ago, if people want to see how they can donate to Kickstarter. And also, if people want to come and take part, is there anything else that they should know? You said signs are provided, t-shirts, I don't know about that. And maybe you can reiterate again when and where. And I just wanted to point it out as well, as of when I checked the Facebook event yesterday, there were 160 people saying that they're going. So this is going to be a great, awesome event.
Yes, I'm hoping too. The whole point of these events is to raise awareness, and we welcome any person that has compassion for animals. They don't have to be vegan, and they just have to be open-minded. I have to mention that we will also be inviting the media. So our message will hopefully reach beyond simply the people that walk by there. Hoping we will connect thousands of others that are home watching the news that night.
We'll have our own media too, right? I think you're having photographers and video and a videographer there. That's great, because getting it on social media is definitely, it's the new media.
Yeah. Well, we are an unstoppable movement. That's what we want to show. We want to take notice, and the more media we have, the more likely to have more events like this. And big turnouts through Facebook, through Instagram, through all the social media.
Well, thanks.
So, yeah, I'm asking people to sign up to the event so our numbers will grow. It makes a difference if we can get 1,000 people in Tel Aviv, I don't see why we cannot get 1,000 people in North America. And the first time it's happening in Vancouver, but why not?
I love that positive thinking. 1,000 people in Tel Aviv, that's amazing. Yeah. And then, the movement definitely is growing. So, yeah, go onto Facebook and add your RSVP there, because I think that just adds momentum and people see that other people are going and then they want to go. So it's Saturday, July the 8th at the Laughing Statues in English Bay. Correct?
12 p.m.
At 12 p.m. Okay, well, thank you, Daphna, for coming on today's show to speak about the upcoming Roaring Silence event happening again next Saturday, July the 8th, 12 p.m. in Vancouver, globally as well. And to find out more, you can also look for the Roaring Silence event on Facebook or visit roaringsilence.ca. Thanks, Daphna. Have a good day.
This week, two former workers at Chilliwack Cattle Sales, the largest dairy factory farm in Canada, pleaded guilty to a total of 3 counts of violating the BC Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act. The Chilliwack Provincial Law Court has sentenced Larson to 20 days in jail and a fine of $4,000. His jail time starts this Friday. Larson is also prohibited from having large animals in his custody or care for a year. Blackwell was sentenced to pay a fine of $7,000, and he is prohibited from having large animals in his custody or care for 3 years. Both offenders have 2 years to pay their fines.
And during the annual American Medical Association conference held in Chicago, it was announced that based on scientific study, all hospitals and medical institutions should not only start to offer plant-based foods in every facility, but should also remove all meat, dairy, and eggs from their menus. I work as a massage therapist, and I was treating a patient in the hospital recently. A staff member came in to take food orders for my patient for the next day, and the options were bacon, eggs, milk, fish, chicken. The only healthy item on the menu was oatmeal. So I actually have now emailed the hospital and requested that they follow suit with what the American Medical Association is recommending. It's time that we stop feeding cancer-causing, artery-clogging foods to people in hospitals. And the maker of vegan mayonnaise has been working on getting lab-made meat onto dinner tables everywhere. It's just that nobody knew about it. Hampton Creek, a company that built its name on plant-based condiments and vegan-friendly cookie doughs, today revealed for the last year it has been secretly developing the technology necessary for producing lab-made meat and seafood, or as the industry likes to call it, clean meat. Perhaps even more surprising is that Hampton Creek expects to beat its closest competitor to market by more than 2 years. Josh Tetrick, CEO of the company, said that by the end of the year, they'll have something out there on the marketplace. And until now, only a handful of global startups have been working on this. And for those of you who don't follow our show regularly, we did actually do an interview a couple of months ago with filmmaker Liz Marshall, her upcoming film is going to be called Meet the Future, where she follows Memphis Meats in their journey to create lab-grown meat as well. And you can find that on animalvoices.org. It's a really interesting interview. And Vancouver City Council voted this week unanimously to ban the retail sale of cats, dogs, and rabbits. Yes. Activists, including animal rights lawyer Anna Pippis, directed staff to look into the feasibility of banning the retail sale of all pets. And I watched the video of the activists speaking at the city council meeting, and I found the councillors to be very receptive to this. So I do hope that this is a possibility.
It's a big win. Of course, I was like checking my Facebook this week to find out what had happened, and I didn't realize that it would pass so easily.
Because I was shocked.
You know, we've had these struggles at the Vancouver Aquarium like for years, mm-hmm. and over a couple of days, I think it took 2 days, this or maybe even just one meeting, they just decided to ban the sale of dogs, cats, and bunnies in retail outlets in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So fish are next, right? We've got
birds, fish, yeah. Iguanas. The main point of the discussion from all of the activists that animals are not commodities, and how many shelters are overrun with animals that have to be put down because people have the option to go to a pet store. Of course, this doesn't solve the issue of backyard breeders or breeders selling through the newspapers, but I do think this is a step in the right direction, and it shows the public that this is wrong and that we need to start focusing more on rescuing animals from shelters rather than buying bred ones.
Yeah, I remember we did an interview quite a few years ago, about 5 years ago, and it was about this issue. It was about breeding and adopting dogs specifically. I remember the person we interviewed, he said that it was Nathan Winograd. He actually said that there are enough dogs in shelters right now for everyone who wants a dog. So there's no need to buy. That. But we will do a show about this more in the future. Thank you for sharing that news with us today, Jillian and Jen. Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
For our feature interview today, we have Dr. Mark Beckhoff on the show, who is a world-renowned animal behavior expert. Mark is a former professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder and is a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society and a past Guggenheim Fellow. In 2000, he was awarded the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society for major long-term contributions to the field of animal behavior. Mark is also involved with many other organizations and advising roles such as the Jane Goodall Institute, Minding Animals International, and Predator Defense. Dr. Beckhoff's main areas of research include animal behavior, cognitive ethology, and behavioral ecology, and he has also published more than 1,000 papers and 30 books on animal issues. His most recent book is called The Animal's Agenda: Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age, co-authored with Jessica Pierce. And in today's interview, we'll be speaking with Mark about some of the issues covered in his book. Hello, Mark, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Oh, thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming on the show today to speak to us about your recently published book, The Animal's Agenda. I always love reading your books, and this one was no exception. I learned a lot, and you've given me new information to explore in the world of animal ethics. To start, I want to talk about the growth of interest in animal welfare. You say there has been a sharp and steady spike in frequency in the use of the term animal welfare from the 1960s until now. Can you tell us about that evolution until today, and the Bramble Report, which was an instigator to some of this growth that we are seeing?
Many people are really interested in how animals are doing in different venues, such as factory farms, zoos, circuses, rodeos, and education, and laboratories, companion animals, and animals in the field. So you see much more of the use of the word animal welfare, or the welfare of the animals. But one of the reasons we wrote the book was simply because we believe that animal welfare really patronizes non-human animals in the name of humans, and we're quite concerned about that. The Bramble Report was published in the mid-60s and contained what are called the five freedoms, and it was motivated in the UK by the way in which, quote, food animals were being reared on, you know, quote, factory farms, basically slaughterhouses. So we're happy to see the word being used more, but we're really very concerned how the mistreatment of non-human animals continues today.
Can you, for our listeners who haven't heard of the five freedoms before, can you summarize what those five freedoms are?
Yeah, I mean, they basically said, you know, animals should be free to have food and water, to have space in which to stretch and stand and, you know, flap their wings, to have social contacts with members of their own species, and basically, you know, be free of pain and suffering. But of course, by virtue of the condition in which these animals are kept, they're not going to be free of pain and suffering. And they really have very little to do with freedom, actually. And that's one of the arguments that we make in our book.
Well, we see the use of welfare science a lot these days in the farmed animal industry. For example, we hear a lot about quote-unquote humanely raised meat, meaning that some of the interests of the animals were taken into consideration in the process of raising and then killing them for meat. So the question of whether or not we should even be using animals is completely bypassed and moved on simply to how can we make modifications to the systems that will offset the suffering of animals to some degree. I'm wondering if you can give us a few examples about how this works in considering the welfare of animals raised for human food. What are some of the types of choices that these animals are given to consider their preferences for less harm over more?
Yeah, I mean, one might be increasing the size of cages for poultry, for chickens, from 68 to 72 square inches. I'm not being facetious. Another might be in zoos increasing the size of an elephant enclosure from 1 acre to 3 or 4 acres. So they're really modifications. And once again, I really want to be clear. I think these people have, quote, good intentions, but good intentions aren't enough. And really, I've had so many people say, you know, there's no difference between 68 and even 88 square inches. And there's no difference really between a 1 and a 3 acre enclosure for an elephant in a zoo or, you know, making a bathtub at a SeaWorld type venue into more of, say, a spa. I mean, I call them feel-good scams because that's what they are. It makes the people feel good that they're taking into account the welfare of animals, but it's not enough.
Right.
That's basically the way we look at it.
Well, I do want to move on now to talk about animals who are held in captivity in zoos and aquariums for human entertainment and so-called conservation and educational purposes. Keeping animals in zoos and aquariums essentially negates the values of the five freedoms because they have no freedoms when they are kept in these places. In your book, you give many examples of how the freedoms of many species of animals have been violated in both zoos and aquariums, far beyond the extent that most humans realize, I think. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about some of these situations that have shown animals to live in miserable settings and even having perfectly healthy animals destroyed in the name of profit.
Yeah, I mean, once again, you know, you could look at factory farming, the animal food industrial complex, and some people like Temple Grandin, for example, has developed what she calls these stairways to heaven, which basically account for the last couple of minutes of the life of, say, a food cow, but it doesn't account for all the misery that they've suffered before they finally get to walk to their death. That would be one. You might have situations where animals are put on display, like zoo animals are put on display. They have no privacy. They're shipped around as breeding machines to, you know, basically to be forced to mate with other animals whom they might not even know. Shipping animals around in zoos and circuses really breaks up family groups, for example. And so it's once again, like I said, I think what happens is you basically just get to the situation where people are trying to give the animals a better life, but a better life is not necessarily a good life.
Right. And you say that animal scientists agree that the techniques and practices used in zoos are actually not ideal and that animals are suffering. And you also talk in your book about zoocosis. I wonder if you can explain that for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, so you look at these animals in zoos who are pacing back and forth and they basically get some kind of, I'm not quite sure I had a capsule other than, say, zoocosis would be some kind of captivity-related behavioral anomaly like stereotype pacing, self-destructive behavior, heightened aggression, depression, you know, basically PTSD, all coming from the stress of the loss of the freedom of movement, the loss of the freedom to decide when they're going to be on display, the loss of the freedoms to reproduce, eat what and when they want, et cetera, et cetera. And these things, just like in human animals, build up to the point where you get this zoocosis or these diseases or these conditions that are related to being confined in cages.
Our co-host Jen here has a question for you, Mark.
One of the main arguments for keeping facilities open, like the Vancouver Aquarium or the Greater Vancouver Zoo, is because these places are so-called educational. But you mention in your book there's actually very little evidence of educational value of zoos and aquariums. Can you tell us about what studies have shown on this subject and how observing animals in these captive situations is actually not conducive to learning about who the animals are?
Yeah, I mean, people will say, zoos, aquariums educate people. They learn something. And sure, we all know people who have gone to a zoo or an aquarium and, you know, very few might say, and that, you know, motivated me to go on to become a biologist or a conservation biologist. In terms of the real education and the, quote, what I call the deep education, there's no evidence for this. In other words, do people leave and then make financial contributions to the animals or the situation, you know, in which they're mainly interested? So the education card, that I call it, it's flimsy at best, and even studies done by zoos show that in the real world, in the long term, there's no real education benefit. I always say I'm an academic, and I love education for education's sake, but the question is, does that mean that it's okay or ethically permissible to keep animals in cages? So to me, the education card is not a particularly convincing one.
So let's talk about the conservation card in zoos and aquariums. It's another purported intention for pro-captivity. You say that zoos are actually putting forward a conservation charade, saying that they are committed to saving wild animals as a way to raise money and gain public support without even doing any conservation work. Can you elaborate on this, please, for us?
Yeah. I'll be honest to say, to me, the conservation card is a mixed bag. There's a lot of zoos that do make a lot of contributions, financial, scientist-wise, to different conservation projects. So the reason I say it's a mixed bag is there's a few that do, but most don't. And so I like to keep the door open there. But once again, it comes back to the question, does this justify keeping individual animals in cages? You know, people like to call them enclosures, or they'll call them, you know, seaquariums, and they'll call them their big ocean-like environment. But they're cages nonetheless to these animals. So I keep the door open. My answer is I'd rather see money go into preserving habitat and working with wild populations, since, in fact, basically few, if any, animals ever go back into the wild from living in captivity.
Is that a scenario that is happening at all? Because I do think that is a solution, is that efforts to save the most vulnerable species should actually be put towards saving them in the wild, not in captivity where they don't do very well. So what does this kind of scenario look like if conservation efforts are being put towards wild habitats and not animals in zoos?
Yeah, I think that some of the projects that are being done, and that's why I call the conservation card a mixed bag, are trying to save wild animals in their natural habitats. But I think the problem that you have is there's too many humans. We're spilling out all over the place. It's really hard to get people to save land when it's hard to get people to save land when there's animals there. It's almost impossible if you would say, we want to preserve this habitat because either animals will migrate naturally into these areas or we're going to place animals there at some later date. People just are not going to do that, and they don't do it.
Well, our co-host Jillian has a question for you now.
Hi, Mark. Let's move on to talk about animals in lab research, which you write about in your book. There are many reasons why using animals in lab research equates to bad science. But one that I think that people really don't know about is the addition of stress to the equation with captive lab animals. And this can affect their physiology to skew lab results. Can you tell us about how compromised welfare results in compromised science?
Yeah, excuse me, that's a great question. There's a lot of, you know, ethics once again. Should we be having these animals in labs? Should we be brutally treating them the way they do in the name of humans? But one of the things that a lot of people don't know, particularly non-researchers, the researchers know it well, but they tend to ignore it, is that a lot of times what you're doing is you're collecting data on stressed animals. So, you know, you do drug tests and the animals are stressed, so the drugs operate in a certain way on stressed individuals rather than on non-stressed individuals. So to me, one of the most compelling things really is for people to become aware of the fact that around 92 of 100 drugs that are tested on animals that work on non-human animals don't work on humans. People quibble about the numbers, but the vast majority do not work. And there's been studies that show that, you know, drugs tested on rabbits living in different conditions actually produce different results. So to me, I would like the ethics to be the major variable and discussion point. But for people who want good science, stress really, really complicates the situation and actually changes the reliability and the validity of the data. Noise in labs, odors in labs, just the living conditions of themselves can be very stressful.
Yeah, and I think that there's actually, that's just like one large reason that I learned about in your book about why lab research equates to bad science. There are others. I encourage our listeners to read the book to find out more. But also in your book, you write about the political dynamics in the venue of animal research that is at play. And I think this is a strong thing to contemplate when considering the value of the use of animals in labs. Now, can you tell us about the realities in the scientific community that unnecessarily uses animals in competition for funding and data results?
Oh, sure. I was part of a lab decades ago, and, you know, the animals are viewed as disposable objects. And once again, people don't believe it, but that's why it's very difficult for non-researchers to go behind the closed doors of laboratories. Another thing that I think is, I look at it in a political way, is that in the United States, rats and mice have been written off as being not animals in the Federal Animal Welfare Act. And there's a clause that says we're redefining the word animal to exclude laboratory rats and laboratory mice. So I always say, well, where have all the scientists gone? You know, they have free access to these quote animals. They say they're studying animal models, but after all, the Federal Animal Welfare Act says they're not animals. And so they can then design and implement studies that are really shoddy. And a lot of it comes to publish or perish competition, you know, that you want to feed a rat something in the morning or do something to the rat's brain in the morning and publish a paper in the afternoon. So people really need to be very aware of this, and they need to be aware of unnecessarily duplication. I mean, maternal deprivation in rhesus monkeys, starving rats to learn about eating disorders in humans. I mean, these studies are, I want to say a dime a dozen, but I mean, there's so many of them when we already know what's happening.
Right. And when we consider the well-being of animals, we know that this interest is enhanced when animals have the ability to control certain aspects of their environment, and certainly when they have freedom. But in a lab research setting, of course, basic freedom is taken away. So, you know, the five freedoms really don't come into play there. But, and if you asked an animal if you could cut him or her open, sever her spinal column, or give him HIV, surely they would say no, as you say in your book. So what is the solution here with regards to doing invasive research on animals, and what do you see in the future for research with no animals being used?
Oh, I think we should just cut out invasive research. Number one, once again, the stress causes us to question the validity of the science. There's ample non-animal alternatives used that should be used, that are available, that are economically and educationally and ethically better than animal models. And one of the things we point out in the book is we call it the knowledge translation gap. What we're learning about non-human animals, and this is global, Canada, United States, throughout the world, is not being used on their behalf. So people will say, scientists will say, well, we don't really know that rats enjoy being tickled or like to play or laugh. Yeah, we do know that, and the data have been collected by really hardcore scientists. So this knowledge translation gap basically demonstrates the fact that even when we have data, the researchers and the people who are legislating animal welfare regulations pay no attention to it.
I remember reading your book recently. There's a part where you talk about where animals can actually volunteer to be part of research studies with, such as with companion animal dogs. I wonder if you can touch upon what that involves so that our listeners can kind of see like where animal research could take us in the future, where animals' freedoms aren't being violated.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons that we, in the book, one of the major arguments is to replace the science of animal welfare with the science of animal well-being, where the well-being and the health, if you will, psychological and physical health of every individual matters. Animal welfare does not pay attention to individuals. And so what I like to think would be that we'll have these changes that really will pay attention to individuals in the, you know, and in the future. And I think that will produce a lot better science, and will, you know, it'll make people think about the moral concerns, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But what it does is it brings back the attention to each and every individual. And some people will say, well, you know, billions of rats are used, billions of mice. No, that's not any excuse. We need to pay attention to each and every individual.
Right. And once again, when it comes to animal welfare science, you say it deflects attention away from moral concerns over animal captivity because it focuses on the immediate welfare challenges and it provides a nice veneer of scientific and thus ethical acceptability to the overall endeavor. Animal welfare presents itself as being value neutral, but yet its core dictates that animals are here for us to use. So in your opinion, is it okay to inflict harm on animals and call it respecting dignity in the name of animal welfareism? Or how do you explain this paradox?
No, it's not. And that's a wonderful question. Like I say, it's all, quote, in the name of humans. People are astounded to learn how little, if anything, from brutally invasive research on non-human animals actually is used to help the animals themselves or their relatives, if you will. So no, there's no respect and dignity. I mean, true welfareists say we're respecting the animals, and I've had discussions very recently with well-intentioned people who they up the standards, like we said before, they make bigger cages, they use anesthesia, analgesics, and they'll see, we're doing better by the animals, but they're not really doing well by the animals. So no, I don't think that they're adequate at all, and I don't see that this is really what I would call deep respect or deep dignity in the name of welfareism. That's like, once again, why we developed the science of animal well-being, that every single animal matters.
Right. I just don't think we can respect animals as individuals when there is something that we call welfare science. Just as your book talks about, welfare science is in the name of using animals. Well, finally, moving forward and acknowledging that if asked, animals would say that they don't want to be used by humans for flesh consumption, for entertainment in zoos, or for lab research. How can we humans strive to do better and allow animals to live out their lives in freedom, just as we aspire to do for ourselves? Now, we've lived so long with using animals for human purposes. What, in your opinion, is the key for making change for the better and reversing the status quo?
Well, once again, one would be focusing on individuals, and another is what we call bringing it home. When we start talking about some of the abuses, we'll say, would you do it to a dog, cat, other companion animal? Or would you allow them to be treated in the way that food animals or entertainment animals or zooed animals are treated? And across the board, with almost no exceptions, people go, oh, heavens, no. Why did you ask? Well, the reason we asked is very simple. Companion dogs and cats and other, so-called pets are no more sentient than cows, mice, rats, even fish, birds, who are used in invasive research. So one way we could, if you will, turn the tide is to get people to bridge the empathy gap, think about dogs, cats, and other animals with whom we're familiar, and then apply that to animals we call ham, bacon, steak, sausage, for example. And I really mean that. I don't mean that in a facetious or a snotty way. I've had, just this week I was talking to somebody and I asked them that question about dogs, and it actually got them to sit and think about it. And I was doing an interview this week, and a woman called in and she said, I was listening to the interview and I was going into the kitchen to eat an egg and I decided I'm not eating eggs anymore. And I don't take that in any, halo sort of way that you should put a halo around my head. We were talking about who we eat, not what we eat. And she actually stopped in her tracks. She called in and said, oh, wow, chickens are whose and not what's. You know what I mean? Chickens are the one few food group who we actually call by name because pigs are sausage and bacon. So I think getting people to change their language, and I think getting people to think about their household companions and getting people to think about individual animals is a way for the future.
And I love the way that you bring out those ideas in your book, The Animal's Agenda. I just really want to recommend this book as for anyone on the spectrum of how they view their ethics to be with regards to the well-being of animals, I recommend this book. So thank you, Mark, for joining us on the show today to speak with us about some of the thought-provoking animal welfare and advocacy topics covered in your latest book, The Animal's Agenda. Once again, listeners, please read the book. And if you'd like to find out more about Mark and his work, you can visit his website at markbeckoff.com. Thank you so much, Mark. Have a good day.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show, Friday, July the 7th, for our Cow Appreciation Show with Elise. And we here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And Allison, do we have a outro song today?
Yeah, it's called Passion for Freedom. What better of a theme for today's show, right? Just what we were talking about. It's by True Nature.
Great. And stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. And remember to be kind to the animals.
Break for all.